this connection. The Chinese and Russians just began a whole week of naval exercises in the East China Sea. There's escalatory dominance there as well. If the Russians ever get in trouble in Ukraine, watch out for what happens in the South China, East China Sea, and across from Taipei. Does the U.S. really want to get involved in a war on two fronts with two other superpowers? It shouldn't, but the people running our policy are so sophomoric that they may throw a tantrum and get us into precisely that kind of threat.
Thank you very much, Eric McGovern, a former CIA analyst, and Fiorella Isabel, journalist and political analyst. Thanks for sharing your thoughts and views with us on this edition of Spotlight.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي مماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك سريع العقاب وإنه لغفور رحيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return. So He will inform you of that in which you differed, and He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving.
This is IRIB.
Headlines: Japan's inflation hit 3.7% in November, the highest since 1981, fueled by higher energy costs. A U.S. congressional panel probing the January 2021 attack on the Capitol releases its final report detailing why former President Donald Trump should face criminal charges. Also ahead, the Centers for Disease Control says life expectancy in the U.S. has hit its lowest in the past 25 years despite hefty spending on healthcare. World News, we're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story: Japan is feeling the pinch of skyrocketing energy costs as official data shows prices of essential commodities rose at their fastest pace last month. According to data released by the Interior Ministry, core consumer prices climbed 3.7% in November compared to the previous year. The rise in prices for processed food items as well as electricity and durable goods has been the highest in the last four decades. The Japanese Central Bank, unlike Western economies, has not yet hiked interest rates to tackle soaring inflation, which have driven down the value of the yen against the dollar. The bank says it sees the recent price increases as temporary and that there is no reason to change course yet. The surge in food and energy prices around the globe has been largely attributed to the ongoing war in Ukraine and the West's standoff with Russia. Now, news of stock markets volatility. Asian shares have plunged after Wall Street witnessed losses fueled by expectations that the Federal Reserve will lift the benchmark lending rate well into next year. Tokyo stocks opened lower on Friday, with the Nikkei index shedding over 1%. Stocks in Hong Kong, Shanghai and Seoul slipped as well. the drops came on the heels of jittery in Wall Street, where the three main indexes ended well in the red on Thursday. Investors in global markets were seen nervous over earnings fluctuations and credit risks this month. Meanwhile, the Bank of Japan has decided to move away from its ultra-loose monetary policy. Other major central banks are also likely to raise interest rates higher than expected. Japan's decision to boost its military spending has drawn strong rebukes from civic leaders in South Korea. Tokyo argues its move to build up its forces comes amid threats from North Korea and China. Tokyo's arms purchases will also provide a boon for U.S. weapons producers. Frank Smith reports from Seoul.
Japan has slowly developed the scope and scale of its military forces since its defeat in World War II, despite its pacifist constitution. Prime Minister Fumio Kishida Friday announced a major shift in its post-war self-defense principle.
When considering strengthening our defense capabilities this time, we will assume various situations and consider whether the current capabilities of self-defense forces can deter threats to Japan based on the capabilities of our opponents and new ways of fighting.
Outside the Japanese embassy in Seoul, South Korea, activists protested against Japan's new military plans. Japan ruled over Korea for much of the first half of the 20th century. Civic leaders argue Japan's force buildup, to include various U.S. missiles and counterstrike strategy, can enable its military to again become offensive in nature.
The Japanese government's so-called counterattack capability actually involves preemptively striking enemy bases in North Korea, China, and Russia with missiles. As a result, Japan's principle of self-defense is completely broken, and the peace constitution, its minimum responsibility as a war criminal state, remained empty.
Japan suggests it's responding to increasing threats from North Korea and China. Over the next 5 years, Japan plans to double its military spending from 1% to 2% of GDP. And much of that, more than $300 billion, is earmarked to be spent in America's military-industrial complex. Japan's new military budget comes just as the U.S. increases its annual military spending to $858 billion. Frank Smith, Seoul.
A U.S. congressional panel probing the 2021 attack on the Capitol building has released its final report. It accuses former President Donald Trump of inciting the deadly riots and engaging in a conspiracy to overturn the 2020 election results. The 800-page report is based on more than 1,000 interviews and hundreds of thousands of documents, as well as federal and state court rulings. The report indicates the former president knew he had lost the election, but still pressured officials and his deputy against the vote outcome. He then directly summoned what the committee calls a violent mob and refused to ask his supporters to leave. The report is made public just days after the panel asked the Justice Department to charge Trump for four crimes, including obstruction and insurrection. It is the first time Congress has referred a former president to criminal prosecution in U.S. history. Trump dismisses the committee and its report as a political witch hunt. An investigation based on Twitter's internal files has revealed that the social media platform helped the U.S. military amplify its online propaganda campaigns about its activities in West Asia. The probe says Twitter granted Pentagon-affiliated accounts more visibility, even allowing fake accounts to push pro-U.S. narratives. At the top of the campaign's agenda was spreading criticism of Iran and showing support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen.
An investigation has shed light on the complicity of social media giant Twitter in the propaganda of the U.S. military in the West Asia region. The investigation says Twitter helped the U.S. military amplify its propaganda campaigns in this region, allowing fake accounts to push pro-U.S. narratives. The probe has been carried out by a journalist and is based on internal documents released by Elon Musk, who took over as Twitter's CEO in October. Musk has released the documents as an effort to boost transparency about the social media platform's operations under the previous management. The investigation says Twitter secretly created a special whitelist exempting accounts run by US Central Command or CENTCOM for spam and abuse flags. The move allowed those accounts greater visibility on the platform. It says Twitter quietly introduced the feature in 2017. The measure was introduced after US military officials asked the company to improve the visibility of Arab language accounts used to amplify certain messages. Those included promoting US military narratives, anti-Iran messages, and support for the US and Saudi-backed war in Yemen. According to the report, CENTCOM concealed its ownership of the accounts. In some cases, it used fake pictures and bios to give them the impression that they were run by civilians in the region. The social media giant tolerated the presence of the accounts on the platform until at least May 2022.
The investigation says the collusion between Twitter and the U.S. military continued until at least May of this year. Twitter has long pledged to shut down all state-backed disinformation and propaganda campaigns. For example, in 2018, Twitter suspended accounts that were allegedly linked to Russia, but these rules and suspensions have not been applied to the American military.
Twitter has long pledged to shut down all state-backed disinformation and propaganda efforts. For example, in 2018, Twitter suspended accounts that were allegedly linked to Russia's propaganda efforts. But these rules and suspensions have not been applied to the American military efforts. The finding of this research appeared to corroborate a major report published in August by online security researchers affiliated with the Stanford Internet Observatory. That report claimed that thousands of accounts that they suspected to be part of a state-backed information operation. It said many of those accounts used photorealistic human faces generated by artificial intelligence and were connected with an online ecosystem that included fake news websites, meme accounts on Telegram and Facebook, and online personalities. They all echoed Pentagon messages and included anti-Iran messages. Some of them accused Iran of threatening Iraq's water security. Others promoted allegations that Iran was harvesting the organs of Afghan refugees. In the summer of 2020, officials from Facebook reportedly identified fake accounts attributed to CENTCOM's influence operation on its platform. Reports show in 2020, Facebook and Twitter executives were invited by the Pentagon's top attorneys to attend classified briefings in a sensitive, compartmented information facility. The result of that meeting was that many of the fake accounts remained active for at least another year. Some of the accounts on the CENTCOM list remain active even now.
Turning elsewhere now, two new reports by the Centers for Disease Control show life expectancy in the U.S. has hit its lowest in the past 25 years. According to the reports, the average life expectancy for Americans shortened by over 7 months last year. That decrease followed another decline of 1.8 years in 2020. The expected lifespan now stands at 76.4 years, which is the lowest since 1996. COVID and overdoses, mostly caused by synthetic drugs, were mentioned as the main factors. In August, the CDC released a report predicting the worst two-year decline, on record in the U.S. since 1923. Life expectancy in the U.S. remains lower than other industrial countries, although it spends the highest amount of money on healthcare. Going to turn to some other news now. Pakistan's parliament has summoned the MPs belonging to the former Prime Minister PTI party in person for the confirmation of their resignations. The lawmakers, however, have not appeared before the custodian of the National Assembly to tender their final resignation. Nasir Kazmi has more from Islamabad.
The Pakistani government called a fresh session of the parliament on Thursday evening after the MPs affiliated to the ex-Prime Minister's Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf party requested the Speaker of the National Assembly for the acceptance of their resignations. The PTI lawmakers did not appear before the Speaker of the National Assembly for the confirmation of their resignations, which they tendered in April following the ouster of former Prime Minister Imran Khan through a vote of no confidence. While responding to a letter written by the top leadership of Khan's party on December 15, the Speaker of the Parliament, Raja Parvez Ashraf, called PTI's MPs to appear one by one in his chamber for the legal exercise under the rules of procedures and conduct of business in the country's National Assembly, terming it as another U-turn of Imran Khan in his political career. The lawmakers belonging to treasury benches criticized the policies of the PTI party chief, saying that agenda of the former prime minister is only to politically destabilize Pakistan.
The Speaker of the National Assembly, through a written letter, asked the PTI lawmakers to come and complete the constitutional requirements for their resignations. But the PTI leadership is using the move as a political stunt. Actually, they are not ready to resign from the parliament.
While defending his party decision, the PTI leadership says that it will approach the country's top court to seek acceptance of their mass resignations instead of the parliament, and will also dissolve the assemblies in Punjab and Khyber Pakhtunkhwa provinces.
Why we are dissolving our own governed assemblies in two key provinces of the country? Because the country is heading towards destruction under the rule of an imported government. The only way to save the country is to hold free, fair and transparent elections.
Amid political tug-of-war in the country, Pakistan's former PM Imran Khan announced last week that he would go to the parliament on Thursday to confirm the resignations of his party lawmakers and dissolve the Punjab and Khyber Pakhtunkhwa assemblies on 3rd of December. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Now, the de facto Taliban government has indefinitely suspended university education for all women in Afghanistan, the latest step in repression against the rights and freedoms of Afghan women. Rahmatullah Baghban has more from Kabul.
The Taliban officials on Tuesday ordered a nationwide ban on university education for Afghan women. Earlier, a letter made public by the spokesman for the Ministry of Higher Education, Ziaullah Hashimi, outlining that the measure would take effect immediately in private and public universities. Today, the Taliban forces barred women from entering Kabul University. Afghan experts warn that the new order will have a devastating impact on the future of women as well as the entire Afghan nation. They urged the Taliban authorities to stop rolling back Afghan women's rights. In addition to oppositions from inside Afghanistan, the United Nations and several countries have condemned the order. They have signaled that the Taliban administration won't get recognition until they equally observe the human rights of all Afghans. After taking power, the Taliban promised a softer role and upholding women's rights. But today, many here say that the Taliban have been failing to abide by their promises. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
Wow. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
On Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
Limelight. As a presidential candidate in 2016, Donald Trump broke decades of precedent by refusing to release his tax forms to the public. However, the Democratic-controlled House Ways and Means Committee has decided to release Donald Trump's tax returns to the public. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Thank you. The Los Angeles Times has covered the story. A House panel voted along party lines on Tuesday, 20th of December, to release former President Donald Trump's tax returns, an unprecedented move that marks the culmination of a years-long legal battle to disclose his financial records. Republicans said the move underscored Democrats' ongoing obsession with Donald Trump, warning that the release would create a dangerous weapon that could be used against other politicians, business executives, labor leaders, and even private citizens. Democrats called the move long overdue. Unlike other modern presidents, Donald Trump, who announced last month that he would run for president again in 2024, has refused to release his tax returns, which would reveal details about the source and size of his wealth, potential financial conflicts, and whether he has paid taxes in recent years. Some legal experts questioned whether the House Ways and Means Committee has adequate legal justification to release the information to the public. Democrats argued in court that their interest in seeing Trump's taxes was based on the need to craft legislation and that they would not simply release confidential information to the public. But now Democrats are under pressure to act, since Republicans will take over the House of Representatives in early January. After meeting privately on Tuesday for more than 4 hours, members of the House Ways and Means Committee quickly voted to release the returns without debate or speeches. "This is not about punishment. This is not about malicious," Chairman Richard Neal, a Democrat from Massachusetts, said after the vote. Richard Neal dismissed predictions that the committee's action would open the door to partisan attempts to release the tax returns of other prominent people. He said Americans have a right to see the tax returns of anyone serving in the highest office of the country. "This is about the presidency, and it's not about the president," Richard Neal said, adding that he plans to introduce legislation that would require audits of future presidents, including the release of tax returns. It's unclear exactly when and how Donald Trump's tax returns, spanning the years 2015 to 2020, will be released to the public. Committee members said after the vote that it could take up to a week to redact from the documents personal information such as Social Security and bank account numbers. The committee also released a summary of Donald Trump's tax return information and a report on the IRS's mandatory presidential audit program. Democrats said they were unsure if the audit program has been active during recent presidencies, but argued it was more necessary with Donald Trump because all presidents since Richard Nixon had released their tax returns and endured public scrutiny from them. CBS News has also covered the same story and tells us more. Portions from 6 years of former President Donald Trump's tax returns will be made public by the democratically controlled House Ways and Means Committee, which voted 24-16 on Tuesday, 20th of December, to release the years of tax records Donald Trump has long tried to shield. The vote was along party lines. House Ways and Means Committee Chair Richard Neal, a Democrat from Massachusetts, on Tuesday night, called for legislation that would require annual audits of a president's taxes. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi urged the House to take the legislation up quickly, which it would have to do since Republicans are set to take control of the chamber next month. On Tuesday night, the committee released two reports, one from its members and another from the Joint Committee on Taxation. The committee said in its report that it was clear that the mandatory audit program was not a priority for the IRS, and the IRS did not audit Donald Trump in the first 2 years he was in office. The former president's individual income tax returns filed in 2018, 2019, and 2020 were not selected for examination until after he left office, and only the 2016 tax return was subjected to a mandatory examination. Richard Neal said after the vote that it would take a few days to release the returns to the public, since there will have to be some redactions to protect sensitive information, such as social security numbers, PIN numbers and bank account numbers. He said they will begin redacting on Tuesday night. Republican ranking member Representative Kevin Brady of Texas said the release will likely include 6 years of Donald Trump's tax returns along with the tax returns of 8 affiliated businesses and audit notes. Representative Kevin Brady said the IRS audits were not complete, so any characterization of the returns themselves, you have to acknowledge this is incomplete at this time, he added. Kevin Brady called the upcoming release a dangerous new political weapon that overturns decades of privacy protections for average taxpayers in the era of political targeting. The Wall Street Journal has also covered the same story and gives us more details. The House Ways and Means Committee voted on Tuesday, 20th of December, to release former President Donald Trump's tax returns. Representative Brendan Boyle, a Democrat from Pennsylvania, a committee member, said he expected the committee to post the full set of Donald Trump's tax returns, except for information such as social security numbers and bank account details. The committee's 24-16 vote, along party lines, followed a more than four-hour closed-door meeting. The committee obtained access to the tax returns late last month after the Supreme Court denied Donald Trump's request for a temporary order that would have blocked the committee from obtaining the tax returns from the Internal Revenue Service, the IRS. The court's order ended a years-long fight but left the Democrats little time to act before they lose control of the House of Representatives majority and the committee on 3rd of January
2023. IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Midstream. War criminal and psychotic liar, Prime Minister-elect of the Zionist entity Benjamin Netanyahu utilized the Saudi Al Arabiya channel in his first interview with an Arab media outlet to launch a series of very traditional lies, dull to the point of political disgust. Netanyahu seemed like a gullible, spoiled brat with that interview, tried to play smart about the peace process, the Palestinian cause, and the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia, claiming that he will discuss the deterioration of the kingdom's relations with the Biden administration. Oh, isn't he Mr. Fix-It-All? During the interview on Thursday, December 15, 2022, he said, "I think we are facing the possibility of not just expanding peace. I think we can have a new peace initiative that would constitute a quantum leap to achieve a solution to both the Arab-Israeli conflict and ultimately the Palestinian-Israeli conflict." Then, in what seems like a monologue out of a Disney movie, Netanyahu said, "I'm referring to what could be a truly wonderful historic peace with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and that peace with Saudi Arabia will change our region in unimaginable ways." Netanyahu spoke about a wonderful historic peace, but only after Saudi Arabia presents all its cards to normalize its relations with the Zionist entity. But is either side here thinking about how such a normalization will affect all the Islamic world, not only Palestine? Only if Al Arabiya journalists would complete their job and ask him what is the type of that peace he sees that would resolve the Arab-Israeli conflict and put an end to the Palestinian calamity. Does it include recognition of United Nations Resolution 1967 of 2012 on the State of Palestine according to the borders that came in the text of that resolution? And does he consider President Mahmoud Abbas a true partner in peace? But that brings the question whether Mahmoud Abbas is the legitimate representative of the Palestinian struggle at this day and age. Or maybe will Netanyahu's government commit to stopping all forms of Judaization of Palestinian areas? Or will his government consider Al-Quds an occupied land that will be the capital of the State of Palestine? Or will they end once and for all the issue of the outcasted Palestinians who took refuge in countries all over the world and negotiated in accordance with international law? Does this historic peace include stopping the Zionist entity from expanding illegal colonial settlements in the West Bank? Or halting its continuous murderous aggression against the largest open-air prison on earth known as the Gaza Strip? These are just some of the clear questions that would define the essence of that wonderful historic peace that Netanyahu spoke of. But it all comes down to this. Does Mohammed bin Salman care about any of the above-mentioned inquiries to begin with? Welcome to the Mideast Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. The official Saudi Al Arabiya channel, the Zionist Prime Minister designate Benjamin Netanyahu appeared speaking about the upcoming normalization between the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the Zionist entity. There's no embarrassment anymore in the appearance of Zionist personalities on Saudi channels, despite the series of lies that those in power inside Saudi Arabia stressing that there is no legalizing relations with the occupation so far. To discuss this issue with us from the occupied West Bank is Dr. Amal Wahdan, human rights advocate. Thank you for being with us. Dr. Amal, now, Netanyahu spoke with Al Arabiya. That was not a surprise for me, at least. But in the interview, which was posted on its English language website, he said, and I quote, "A new peace initiative aimed at establishing a wonderful, historic peace with Saudi Arabia." Why is Saudi Arabia doing this move right now? And I mean, having him on the national TV if they don't want to normalize?
Well, I think that Saudi Arabia is not in a rush to do such a move, such a huge move, especially if we take into consideration the global arena and the developments, especially the last OPEC Plus meetings, and the differences that start to float between Saudi Arabia and the USA. So I think the Saudis are, you know, just trying to give, but not wholly, because they know that there is a lot in stake if they do go in full normalizations with the Israelis. if they can do behind the scenes relationships and, you know, Israeli airplanes flying over Saudi Arabia, this is something that is not going to harm them much, although they lost, in front of the, at least the Arab nationals and the axis of resistance. Mm-hmm. But on the other side, going fully normalization with the Israelis is a little bit risky for them. It's like, suiciding, because they will lose a lot. But if they can manage these relations away from fully normalizations, I think they will go for it. Actually, on last July, the foreign minister of Saudi Arabia said that there is no normalizations with Israel, I quote, until two-state solution with the Palestinians. And this was like a few months ago. Mm-hmm. And this should be based on UN resolutions and withdrawal from other countries as well. I don't think that the Saudis are ready to make this lead.
Which is why, if we go to the interview, we see that Netanyahu is stressing that peace with Saudi Arabia, and I quote, will change the region in unimaginable ways. In what ways does it mean? I mean, the Abraham Accord with the UAE and Bahrain have changed nothing so far, and the proof, especially about the Arab sentiment during the World Cup that we saw in Qatar 2022, was against such normalization and in support of Palestine. So what does Netanyahu exactly mean by saying it will change the region?
We all know that Netanyahu is good in PR. He tries to impress the coalition. He's trying to impress the people inside the colonial apartheid regime in Palestine. But he cannot go ahead with this step before the Saudis before the Saudis give him this ticket to go ahead. They know the complications, and they are fully aware that this PR show that he makes in front of the TV, and I'm sure maybe he pressed a lot to make this interview with Al Arabiya and other Arab networks, I don't think that it's gonna happen, and I don't think even with the problems that Netanyahu is facing forming this government, even with the ultra-nationalist, ultra-zealous parties in this coalition, I don't think that he is capable of making this government. He has 2 days left on the 21st. If he doesn't succeed, mm-hmm. he will not be able to make this government happen. So I don't think that it goes beyond, it will go beyond this PR show that he's trying to make.
I hear you, what you're saying. It is basically a PR campaign by Netanyahu to boost the polls on the inside of the occupied territories. But earlier last week, we did hear Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu revealing that he recently visited Arab countries that do not maintain relations with the Zionist Israeli entity. Everyone was suspicious that it might have been the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, but not a word was uttered against it or with it. What will the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia be risking in specific at this moment in time if they go along with whatever Netanyahu is pushing them towards, especially with this kind of normalization? What is the riskiest move that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia can make at this current moment in history?
We know that Saudi Arabia is trying to lead the Arab and somehow the Muslim world. So if they do this such step, it's going to hinder, and it's going to really endanger their relations together with the Arab world and with the rest of the Muslim world. I do think that with the differences and the quarrels that they started to have after the OPEC Plus and even before with the Biden administration, and before that, we should remind the people about, you know, the amount of insult and humiliation that Mohammed bin Salman had with the previous administration. So all this is not being silenced. One of the reporters, Israeli reporters, actually, quoted bin Salman reminding Biden of Shirin Abu Akle murder. Mm-hmm. When Biden was bickering at him about Khashoggi, he immediately pointed out the brutal killing of Shirin Abu Akle. So the amount of differences and the amount of quarrels, even though we know that the Americans are not letting Saudi Arabia go to the east, with the Russians and the Chinese. So still now they feel like they have to balance their relations on the international arena. Inside the occupied territories, inside historic Palestine, the confrontations and the amount of aggression that the Israelis are enforcing against the Palestinians has also its weight, whether this move is going to bring peace and stability, as Netanyahu is saying, or it would accelerate the confrontations and elevate even the armed struggle in the West Bank.
Definitely, we have to wait and see then what will be the reply or response of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia to such a push from Netanyahu. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Amal Wahdan, human rights advocate, for joining us from the West Bank to talk about this issue. I wish you the best. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about how might Mohammed bin Salman reciprocate to the calling of Netanyahu. Will he approve or not? Next.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
After the recent electoral victory of Zionist Israeli Prime Minister-elect Benjamin Netanyahu, along with other right-wing Israeli politicians, his first foreign policy move was towards the conservative Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, which houses Mecca, the holiest place for Muslims. Netanyahu's first time on an Arab TV channel was used and abused to push the kingdom into accepting what Netanyahu deemed a quantum leap for peace. Will Mohammed bin Salman take that leap and join the Abraham Accord without securing any gains for the Palestinians? More in this following report.
With a tense atmosphere inside the Israeli entity as the formation of the Zionist government approaches and security in the Palestinian areas continue to decline, Zionist Prime Minister-designate Benjamin Netanyahu will need to bring forth a real achievement to ensure his new government withstands these circumstances. As countries in West Asia move to reposition themselves to face new perceived threats, considering the ongoing war in Ukraine, a major new deal, and one previously considered implausible, appears to be emerging, as per Netanyahu himself during his first appearance on an Arab TV channel, the Saudi Al-Arabiya. Netanyahu openly spoke during the interview that he can strike an unprecedented peace deal with the conservative kingdom of Saudi Arabia, which houses Mecca, the holiest place for Muslims, and a country that still has its school books referring to the Zionist occupation as the Zionist enemy. When one approaches the issue to analyze the facts, one can see that it is actually Netanyahu who desperately needs this type of deal with the kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and hence used his appearance on Al Arabiya to drag the kingdom into a deal that would ease the pressure of Netanyahu's already unborn government, which this time includes Zionist hardliners who have never made it to power yet. This fact has already made way for Netanyahu's opposers to voice their genuine fear of how the arrival of hardliners will only escalate the confrontation with the Palestinian resistance. It is true that warming relations with the Israeli entity have also been a recognized approach for Arab regimes whenever they face internal challenges, with a view to drumming up American and Western support against local opposition by appearing moderate, open, and tolerant. Three words now highly valued by Arab regimes facing survival issues. Netanyahu had already delivered a precious historic deal in August and September 2020 with the so-called Abraham Accords. It began with decisions taken by the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain to enter into peace agreements with Israel. Sudan and Morocco followed soon thereafter. But what exactly did any of the signatories achieve since then? What did Israel really benefit from when the most important factor being the popular support was nowhere to be found, as evident by the FIFA World Cup that took place in Qatar, showcasing the Arabian public's support of the Palestinian cause and their disapproval of the Abraham Accord or anything that resembles it? Many analysts believe that Bahrain's deal with Israel could have only come about with a green light from Saudi Arabia, considering the close relationship between Manama and Riyadh. Many observers also believe that more steps will be taken to ease normalization between the Zionists and the Saudis following Biden's visit to Saudi Arabia, but rather what came was a massive dispute between Biden and Mohammed bin Salman following OPEC Plus's decision to reduce oil production. Put simply, Saudi Arabia does not have to fully enter the Abraham Accords to be a part of the Arab world's trend towards normalization, despite the ongoing deals of the Red Sea islands of Tehran and Sanafir and lifting restrictions on Israeli airlines using its airspace and featuring Netanyahu on Al Arabiya channel. But whether Netanyahu will be satisfied with just that remains to be seen.
Now to discuss this issue with us right here from Beirut is Ali Murad, journalist at Al Akhbar News Daily and political commentator and researcher. Thank you very much, Ali, for being with us. Now, Saudi Arabia has already lifted restrictions on Israeli airlines to use Saudi airspace, and Tel Aviv has also approved the transfer of the Red Sea islands of Tirad and Sanafir from Egypt to Saudi Arabia. I don't know why they had to approve, but that's how it's done. And now Saudis watched Netanyahu on their national Al Arabiya channel. Isn't all that already normalization?
No doubt that when such a Saudi broadcaster interviews a war criminal like Netanyahu is enough evidence for the presence of a normalization between both entities, which has been there already for many years now and possibly many decades. There is nothing new here. What is new actually is the regime inside Saudi Arabia decided to patch up the level of indicators that prove the existence of a previous relationship. And it proves the existence of ambition and willingness to move forward in the process of normalization and its announcement. Of course, the Zionist side is the most expressive of the existence of this relationship, and the announcement of the steps that, from the Zionist perspective, are considered advanced within the framework of the declaration of normalization. While on the Saudi side, we always see that there is an expression of a declaration of readiness for normalization, but they verbally invoke the rights of the Palestinians. But in fact, the Saudis want something related to their own interests in exchange for announcing normalization. This is the rule from which we must proceed when analyzing when Saudi Arabia will announce official normalization with the Zionist enemy. The issue is related to US protection. All the events that have taken place in the region, especially in the past 5 or 7 years since Mohammed bin Salman came to power in Saudi Arabia, indicate that he is ready, enthusiastic and completely convinced of normalizing relations with the Israeli enemy. But he links the issue with what he wants from the Americans, especially in them providing him the umbrella of protection he needs primarily against his own people. because the main fear of these dictatorial regimes comes from the fear from their own people, before they even talk about a danger that may come to them from abroad. And here they mean the revolutionary thought sponsored by the Islamic Republic of Iran in confronting the Zionist enemy, such as supporting the resistance movements. They see this revolutionary thought as a danger. Mohammed bin Salman wants to withdraw an American reaffirmation of the guarantees in the matter of protection in order to announce the steps of normalization. This was said by many Americans who visited Riyadh in the past months and years. Every once in a while, this matter is confirmed through what these officials and journalists say and write.
Listen to what you're saying, because Saudi Arabia's current position, especially the official one, is that it will not normalize relations with the Israeli entity unless and until the Palestinians have a sovereign and independent state based on the 1949 to 1967 borders. Now, the kingdom does not even mention Gaza. They don't mention the expanding of settlements. They don't mention what's going on in Jenin right now, nor the refugees and their right of return. But if the only thing that they want is a business deal, then why call it a peace deal?
As is well known, Saudi Arabia has already started trade relations with the Zionists. The NEOM project announced by Mohammed bin Salman has significant investments for the Israeli side. Also, all the projects announced by Saudi Arabia with Egypt in 2016 and 2017 of enhancing infrastructure like so-called King Salman Bridge between Tabuk and Sinai. This is all linked to the transfer of sovereignty over Tehran and Sanafir from the Egyptian side to the Saudi side. It was simply a preparation for the investment projects taking place between Saudi Arabia and the Zionist entity. I imagine that Saudi Arabia is still embarrassed by an issue related to legality. I mean, they believe and know that the moment they announce the political normalization agreement and conduct a diplomatic exchange with the Zionists, they know that this will damage their image in the Islamic world, in the sense that they are the protectors or custodians of the two holy mosques in Mecca and Medina. This issue was highly considered by the Saudi leadership, so they are going against the natural approach in the issue of normalization. They establish all the relationships that result from the normalization process in the first place, and the step of announcing normalization would be left for the last phase. This is what Netanyahu said in his interview with Al Arabiya. He said that Arabs have always believed that the solution should be done first with the Palestinians, and then comes a normalization of the Arab countries with Israel. Now, the so-called Abraham Accords have proven otherwise. So from their perspective, it is possible to establish relations and establish trade exchange and whatnot, and then later on the rights of the Palestinians can be discussed. Netanyahu is trying to promote the idea by showing how it happened with the UAE and Bahrain.
But there's one other thing that Netanyahu mentioned is the common foe for both entities here, which is the Islamic Republic of Iran, who Netanyahu vowed during the interview that, I quote, we'll do whatever it takes or whatever is necessary to stop Iran from having a nuclear arsenal, even without U.S. consent. But will that appeal to Mohammed bin Salman that, hey, we have a common enemy here, will that appeal to him? Or rather, the regional shifts might have already changed Mohammed bin Salman's priorities from this right now.
This announcement by Netanyahu is not new. He has been saying this since before 2009, when he came to power in the Zionist entity. Now he is trying to use this narrative only to capitalize on the current situation, as there is no progress in the nuclear negotiations between the Islamic Republic of Iran and the P5+1 countries. Netanyahu is trying to seize this moment in order to reassure the Saudis and others that this is a historic opportunity that must be seized. In my opinion, Saudi Arabia knows the dangers of declaring an open alliance with the Zionist entity in confronting the Islamic Republic of Iran and the regional resistance movements, although this alliance already exists under the table. For example, Saudi Arabia's classification of Hamas as a terrorist movement and all resistance movements as a terrorist movement, as well as the imprisonment of Hamas leaders in Saudi Arabia, was the best evidence and proof that Saudi Arabia is walking beside the Zionist entity in an alliance to confront the forces of liberation in the region, on top of which is the Islamic Republic of Iran. So I think Netanyahu is trying to make a showmanship, and he's good at that, by the way. He is good at taking advantage of circumstances, especially when there are certain heated events happening. Today, the situation in the Islamic Republic and Netanyahu's words about it and how he should benefit from this situation in partnership with the Saudis, in my opinion, is the biggest evidence that a large part of what concerns the relationship between the Zionist entity and Saudi Arabia has to do with the joint plans that are being implemented inside Iran.
Which brings to the table the weight and for the response of Mohammed bin Salman. How will it be? Will it be through the foreign ministry, or will it be through him directly to this call by Netanyahu? I want to thank you very much, Mr. Ali Murad, journalist at Al Akhbar Daily newspaper, political commentator and researcher, for joining us to talk about this matter. And thank you, ladies and gents. Please do follow us weekly, because we always have a new episode for you. That's why we'll see you again next week on the Media Stream. Salam.
The Limelight.
According to analysts, the crisis of gas shortages in Europe and the possibility of citizens turning to electric heating devices will put Europe on the verge of widespread blackouts. They say next winter we will see larger regional blackouts in Europe. The risk of industrial closures, power outages, and blackouts due to gas shortages lurks among European citizens in the cold winter, which can also lead to regional tensions. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more.